This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Tony Stovall, who studies the right to consume as a clinical associate professor of marketing at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. There's an overlap of about 10 seconds, so we can pick up right where we left off in The People Behind the PhDs.
Job, but at that point I'd been in IT for so long, like, what kind of job am I going to get? Who's going to let me do what I want to do? So I decided to go get an MBA.
Okay.
I said that will let me make the career switch, a transition from IT to something else, to management, to marketing, to whatever.
Okay.
So I did that.
So where did you apply and where did you get in?
Because I knew I had to keep working, so I was looking for executive MBA programs, which are programs that allow you usually over weekends or evenings to go to school. And I found one that was every other weekend, and this is at the University of Arizona. And even though I was living in LA, the program was based in the executive MBA program for Arizona is actually in Phoenix.
Okay.
So every other weekend I flew to Phoenix.
Wow.
For class. And, you know, people say, why did you choose Arizona? Why not any of the LA schools? It's like, well, the, you know, University of Arizona at the time was roughly $50,000 cheaper.
Yeah, okay.
Than the cheapest LA option. So that's, you know, cost was a factor. I was going to be footing this bill by myself. So I did that. And while I was in my MBA program, I graduated, unfortunately, in 2008. Right as the economy went off the cliff. And I was like, oh no, now I'm going to be stuck. No one's going to hire, people aren't hiring anybody. That was, you know, when the recession hit and it hit big time. So I was like, oh, now I'm stuck. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And one of my professors, my statistics professor, whom I believe you know, Lisa Ordonez.
Yes, I do.
Yes, she was my statistics professor in my MBA program, and she said, you should consider getting a PhD. It's a great life. I think you'd be really good. Just look into it.
So this is halfway through your MBA program as you're commuting between Los Angeles and Phoenix every other weekend.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to, you know, okay, now I know the economy is tanking. It's not likely that I'll be able to make a career transition or career switch. What's next? What do I do now that this is not likely to be a possibility, at least right now?
Mm-hmm.
And so, as I said, Dr. Ordonez told me, or encouraged me to apply for a PhD, and she is the reason that I decided to go back to school to get my PhD after the MBA.
Okay, so just time frame wise, so you'd finished your MBA, what, in 2 years or something in this executive program?
Yeah, 2008.
Oh, you finished your MBA in 2008. Then you go back to Los Angeles and stay in Los Angeles for a couple of years to live for a while?
I stay in Los Angeles for about a year.
Okay.
And then I apply to PhD programs.
Okay. And which PhD? You applied to University of Arizona, obviously, but did you apply to other PhD programs?
I did. I applied to quite a number of them. And, you know, just for me, you know, full transparency, it's like I didn't, at that point, it had been basically 30 years since I'd taken any kind of standardized test.
Yeah.
Because for the executive MBA, they didn't require a GMAT. They just required, it was based on your work experience, your years of experience. So I hadn't had to take a standardized test since the SAT. Basically. And I was like, and I was overconfident. I was like, oh, I'm fine. I can do this. I can do this. And so I basically went to the GMAT cold.
Okay. Is that like being a polar bear or something? Is that like being a polar bear? You know, you just jump into the cold water. Is it something like that?
Exactly. It's like, it's fine. I can do this. It'll all come back to me.
And that's confidence, Tony.
I know. It's stupid confidence. Yeah, ridiculous. Because, you know, you're thinking, it's like, wait a minute. Because the math that, you know, that's on the GMAT, it's like that's 10th grade math. So at this point, it had been over 20 years since I'd had that level of math, and it was like, okay, it's coming back to me, but you know, the GMAT is timed, so I couldn't quite recall those formulas quite so quickly. And so, and because the GMAT is on the computer, it's administered on the computer now. And so I wasn't familiar with that testing format. And basically, you know, I had the little Scantron where you fill in the bubbles. So that's what I was used to. And so this on the computer, and, you know, now it's a computer adaptive test. So it adjusts the level of questions to your ability.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get a question wrong, the next question is easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so then you realize as you're taking it, oh, no, this question is easy. Oh, crap, I must have missed the last one. Oh, no, oh, my gosh. And so you're psyching yourself out of this computer as you're going through this test, and then you end up trying to rush and trying not paying attention. And so, it was just a disaster for me.
Wow. So What did it lead to not getting into a PhD program, or what happened?
Oh, yes, it actually led to not getting into any of them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Originally. And so then, yeah, so I was on a couple of wait lists. And then I called, you know, Lisa Ordonez, and I said, okay, it doesn't look like I'm going to get in. I'll probably have to wait next year. And she said, well, wait a minute. She said, you know, at Arizona, she goes, we have a PhD in retailing and consumer sciences, which is very similar to marketing. I know the director of the program. Just call her and see what she says.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah, so I did. I put in a call, and I said, you know, Lisa Ordonez recommended that I call you. This is my situation. And Dr. Anita Bapu, she was a director at the time, and she said, well, send me your stuff so that if something happens, we'll have it here and we don't have to go through that process.
Oh, wow.
So I did that day. I sent her my stuff. And then 2 days later, she called and said, well, somebody's deferred, so we can offer you a slot.
Well, so this is sort of like, you know, you fail to get in the front door, but then you're able to get into the side door. I mean,
yes.
It's through your credentials, but it's transferred to a different program.
Exactly. A different program, which for all intents and purposes is the same. I mean, you study the same theories, the same, you know, the same basic structures and all these kinds of things. Models and all these are basically the same in retailing as in marketing, because, you know, retailing is a part of marketing.
Yes.
And actually the first academic journal in the field of marketing is the Journal of Retailing.
Okay.
The oldest journal. So even though people like to say there's a difference, it's really a distinction without a difference in my mind. So, yeah, so that was my PhD. It's in retailing. And the rest is history.
This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com. Yeah, so tell us, yeah, so this may be one story. So, you know, the story to get into a PhD is a long and windy one, which is fascinating. I think it's a good story for people who may be listening, thinking maybe they're 25 at this point in their life and they're not sure, but they have certain instincts about their life and they're doing something they're not exactly excited about now. But, you know, I think it's a good story to let people know that you can do a PhD, you know, at 22 if you're so inclined, or at 40 if you're so inclined. As long as you kind of hold on to that dream and continue to work towards it in some way, direct or indirect. So you finally get into the PhD. This had been a goal of yours since your end of your Stanford bachelor's career.
Yes.
So
yeah,
you get in.
But I was like, what am I getting a PhD in? What am I interested in enough to get a PhD? Because I knew that, you know, that it was long and, you know, an arduous journey. And it's very even though you're taking classes, it's very singular. It's like you have to be individually and singularly motivated in order to stay the course and to, you know, to get a PhD. It's like there's no one, it's not like any of your other schooling where there's, you know, someone always breathing down your neck. It's like once you pass your comprehensive exams, it's on you to get it done.
Yeah, so people who don't know, so what Tony's referring to, so the first couple of years of PhD, let's say the first two and a half, look a lot like doing a master's degree or even a lot like doing advanced courses in your bachelor's degree. You take courses, they're intense, they're hard, but they have exams and papers and so forth. So very traditional sort of feel for the work you're doing as a student. But once you get past a comprehensive exam or a qualifying exam, which is an exam you take halfway through your PhD, in order to advance to, it's called candidacy, to say that, okay, this person is now good enough to continue his studies or her studies. That's what Tony's referring to. He got past that, and once you're past that point in your PhD studies, you are completely, in so many ways, on your own. So motivation is suddenly very different because you have to figure things out on your own. So I started off this program, Tony, by saying that you study electronic markets, the right to consumption, so consumption is a political relationship, digital ownership, and consumer well-being. So how did you, if you want to choose one of those, how did you come across studying that? What things from your background, which is super fascinating, led to you saying, I want to study this as a concept within the world of academia?
Right. Well, I can talk about the right to consume because I'm working currently on some projects in that realm.
Okay.
And basically what happened was, for me, it's like I'm very, very fascinated by cities and how they work and why they work. And, you know, if you've ever been to New York City and you stop and think about the logistics of it and the actual, just the physical presence and how many people are there, it's like, this should not work.
Okay.
There's no way that, you know, if any logical person, if you said, okay, we're going to put, you know, 8 million people, 10 million people on an island and have them get along and for the most part, you know, coexist peacefully for the most part. It's like, that makes no sense. Mm-hmm. That should not work. Yet somehow it does. We have these collective agreements that we make that allow us to navigate those kinds of spaces together. So I'm very interested in how that works, and I'm really particularly interested in the concept of gentrification.
Okay.
And that is when, you know, especially in the inner cities where now, you know, we've had, you may be familiar with the term white flight, where people left the inner city and moved out to the suburbs. Well, now what's happening is people are moving back into the inner city and quote-unquote reclaiming the city, the inner city, as their own or for themselves. And so I'm interested in what happens to those people who are displaced, to those people who are, for lack of a better term, gentrified out of their existing neighborhoods.
So just a so quick thing. So the white flight kind of refers to, you know, 70s, 80s time frame, more or less, in America, where Caucasian folks from inner cities left to go to suburbs. The gentrification refers to those people coming back towards the inner city or the inner circle of a city, whatever term, I'm not using the term correctly. And you're interested in when these folks come back, you know, in very general terms, I'm talking about these folks, what happens to the people who are there and their displacement from that place? That's exactly what you're referring to. Okay, thank you.
Exactly. So, yeah, so what happens when, you know, when Restoration Hardware moves into your neighborhood in Harlem and, you know, your mom and pop hardware store that you used to be able to go to no longer exists because you have Restoration Hardware, you have stores like Pottery Barn and all of these, you know, quote unquote higher end stores. So basically your ability to consume in your neighborhood has now been taken away. So basically, your ability to consume in your neighborhood has now been taken away. So I can't go to, you know, when Whole Foods moves in at the grocery store in your neighborhood. Whereas before it was, you know, the mom and pop in New York City, you know, you may be familiar with the term bodegas, the little mom and pop shops, where you could go in and buy what you needed as far as groceries sometimes at a, you know, insanely high markup, but you could do it. You had access to these things. And now what's happening is these big conglomerate grocery stores like Whole Foods, like, depending upon the country, Kroger, Safeway, they're coming into these inner cities and making these deluxe shopping experiences. So
what I don't understand so far, Tony, and like I have this little critical voice going off inside of my head, you say the right to consume. And so part of me is thinking, okay, so a Whole Foods comes to Harlem. And, you know, if I'm putting myself in Harlem, I'm like, wow, suddenly Whole Foods is here. That's great. I still have the right to consume products. Now I get to go to Whole Foods versus the corner bodega. And for any people who don't know, bodega is like a corner Circle K or 7-Eleven. So where does this this rub come in? Because obviously your study focuses on some sort of rub. And can you kind of unpack that for people a little bit?
Oh, sure. Well, when you say, you know, well, now that Whole Foods is in my, you know, in my neighborhood, I can go there. So yes, that works in theory. Yes, of course you can go there. You live there. You're a human being. You are able to go to the store. However, like, you know, you may be familiar with the joke term that we call, you know, Whole Foods, whole paycheck. So you go in and, you know, you get, you know, four or five items and you come out, you know, $100 later.
This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com. So you get yogurt, granola, and a piece of fruit, and that's $25.
Exactly. So now, yes, in theory, I can shop there if I live in Harlem, but I don't make enough money to actually do that.
Okay.
So now you have priced me out of the consumption game. Now I can no longer afford to consume in my neighborhood. In order to get the groceries that I need to survive, I have to now go outside of my neighborhood. If I don't have a car, you know, if I'm in New York City, let's say, it's like, okay, that may mean, you know, several subway rides, changing buses, all of these kinds of things to navigate just to get the basics for survival, whereas before they were available in my neighborhood.
So can you take us over the bridge? Because I feel like there's a bridge you're crossing. So I now understand better the idea of now I'm priced out of my own local market. I can't go to my bodega and buy, you know, loaf of bread and a few other things for $3 or $4. Now I can't even afford anything in my own local neighborhood. But this seems like very much a straight economic type of argument. How has this become like a political, how does consumption then becomes a political relationship? Can you walk us over that bridge a little bit?
Oh, sure. Well, when you look at it, you know, from that side, like, yes, I can no longer afford to consume. I can no longer afford. The bodega, you can't go to the bodega because now it no longer exists. Right, because Whole Foods has come and has put that out of business. Mm-hmm. So there literally is no place for you to go. So yes, it is an economic issue, but in this we're looking at it through both the economic and the political lens. It's like, okay, so for lack of a better term, it's like, you know, white people are moving back into Harlem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they say, oh, I live in Harlem, trying to recall this era of bygone, you know, some of the mysticism that comes along with Harlem, and we think of the Harlem Renaissance and all of the arts and all the culture that came from Harlem.
Yeah, a lot of American culture is born in Harlem, absolutely.
Exactly. But then you think about it, it's like, okay, well, your very presence in Harlem means that it's no longer that Harlem.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm just trying to, because this is your study, so I'm trying to conceptualize it for me and maybe someone else who doesn't study this like you do. So the political part comes in. I live in this place, and there's these things that happen. The things that happen are, you know, a Whole Foods comes to town in my neighborhood, and suddenly it becomes virtually impossible for me to live in this place because I can't afford to consume things anymore. And so this basic consumption thing becomes something very, very different quickly, which is a political reality of I need to live, you know, in a way that's fairly predictable and easy. I can't, you know, commute, you know, an hour and a half to Queens to go to a store and then commute back. That's a hardship on me. And this is how
right. This
consumption becomes political, because it bridge works.
Yes, exactly. And so you're setting up, you know, once again, it's this us versus them dynamic.
Okay.
It's like, and who gets to decide the future of Harlem? The people that have lived there and made Harlem what it is and what it means to America, or the new people that are moving in and basically dictating the consumption that's coming in? It's like, you know, Starbucks is coming in, Whole Foods is coming in, Restoration Hardware is coming in, because that's what we, the new Harlemites, are looking to consume. That's how we gain our identity, by shopping at these stores. We don't shop at the bodega.
So I have sort of two questions. One is backward looking, one is forward looking. So, you know, someone might, you know, hear this Harlem example, which is a great one, and say, well, isn't this the story of, you know, America or any, you know, urban place in the world, where you have these waves of history of, like, wealth coming in and then wealth coming back, and people who were there create an artistic place that makes it attractive to begin with. Isn't this just the ebb and flow of things? And then the other story, other question I have is more forward looking. So if your own open question is, you know, whose Harlem is this? You can answer that question. So maybe you can answer the first question first, the backward looking story. Isn't this just the ebb and flow of any neighborhood that's popular anywhere in the world, or especially in the United States?
No, it absolutely is, but we're looking at it with a more critical eye and basically saying, so what happens to those people who are displaced? And when we talk about the right to consume, it's like, is the right to healthy food, is that a human right?
Okay.
And if it is, whose job is it to make sure that that right is upheld?
So 100 years ago, New York City, Italians and Jews and Eastern Europeans were flooding into the city, and there was rubs with those folks and the people who were already there, so maybe more Anglo and African-American. And at the time, that was happening like it is 100 years later, which is now. But now the difference is that we have some human history to analyze this and think through these issues critically and what the impacts are. That's the huge difference right now, is the ability to think through this moment and how it's going to affect things later. That's a huge difference.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like we've seen this before. We've seen this before, and it, you know, for those who've been displaced, it doesn't end well. So how do we change that narrative to make it such that, hey, this is everyone's Harlem. We can all live here. We can all coexist. We can all consume, and not have this, you know, us versus them dynamic.
But okay.
In order to bring these in, we have to move you out.
So tell us about a displacement story, previously. So a displacement story previously is people have had to move out of the neighborhoods, and where do those folks end up going or have to go? What are their choices they end up having to make when they're displaced from their neighborhood?
Right. And that's just part of the initial story. And so it does, you know, it gets to all of these issues. You know, similar things are happening, like you say, in cities all around the country, all over the world. I just picked Harlem because that's probably something that most people are familiar with. But if you look at, you know, the same thing is happening in San Francisco. If you look at some of the traditionally or recent history have been the gay enclave, like the Castro. It's like if you look at that area, it's like that is being gentrified as well. And so now straight couples with babies and things are moving in,
mm-hmm.
and displacing the gay people.
Uh-huh.
And the artistic people. So where does, you know, San Francisco used to be the home of the counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
But now with tech, all of these high tech, you know, the IT, which is the other part, you know, the other part of what I study, it's like this is all moving in and displacing that. So where does that energy, where does culture, where is that created now that the home where, you know, where this all happened, this, you know, the summer of love, you know, that was all from San Francisco. It's like, so where is that new place and what does that look like?
Yeah, so that sounds like a very much esoteric, much more like an esoteric question. Where does this energy go now? So
yes.
One of the questions you asked, it was an open question, is, whose Harlem is it? I mean, you kind of asked a question like that. So if you had to answer that, your own question, how would you answer it? Or in which way would you answer the question?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question. That's what we're trying to get to. You know, I would like to say, you know, that it's everyone's Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
But what does, you know, if that is the answer, what does that look like? What does that actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
That it's everyone's Harlem. Like, what does a Harlem look like where everyone is just peacefully coexists, where you have lower income people, where you have people at the upper echelons of, you know, the economic ladder? Like, what does that look like when everybody is, you know, is there and just and living and consuming together? And, you know, it's like it is an economic question, but it's also a political question.
Absolutely. So this becomes like a city planning question, which immediately you can think like city hall and city councils working through mixed use space and creating enough different types of incentive structures so that people who want to come in and develop a piece of land can do so, but also make sure that people who live there can still afford to go into their bodega because they're in a different socioeconomic status. That's where it becomes extremely political very, very quickly.
Yes. Exactly.
So let's one final question before we end the show, Tony, is so if anyone is thinking about doing a PhD and they've listened to your, you know, fascinating story, what advice would you give someone?
Oh, wow. Okay. That is, you know, people, when I ask people for advice, you know, their number one piece of advice was don't do it.
It's a bad life choice.
Exactly, yeah. It's like, oh my, you know, especially, I mean, it's, you have to be, like, the single piece of advice I would give is, like, you have to be certain that this is really what you want and understand what your end goal is in doing it. If you're just doing it to get the knowledge, then there are easier ways to do that. If you, you know, you want to teach, then absolutely it is an avenue. It's not the only avenue to get there. And also, you know, as unfortunately true as it is, the discipline in which you get your PhD matters as far as your job prospects on the other end.
Yes, it does.
You know, for me, it's like I have a PhD in a business discipline, so it means I can be employed in a business school, which there are more openings than PhDs to fill
mm-hmm.
in business schools.
Absolutely.
Now, you know, if you're English, philosophy, that kind of thing, which, you know, I am by no means denigrating those fields, but just understand it's like, you know, you have, you know, some programs that are graduating, you know, 10, 15 PhDs in English every year, and that's just one program. And if you've got all of these schools, pretty much anyone who has a PhD program has a PhD in English in those fields, and so you've got to think about it. It's like, okay, if I'm doing this, what is the likelihood that I'm going to get a job
mm-hmm.
in academia, if that's what you want?
Okay.
So understanding your end goal, I think, going in, because it's a lot of work. It's very hard. It's very challenging. It's probably, not probably, it is the hardest thing you'll ever have to do.
Intellectually, at least.
Exactly. Intellectually. So it's not for the faint of heart. It's lonely. But ultimately, it's worth it.
That's great.
Because it is a good life. So.
Great. So, Tony, thanks so much for being on the show today and sharing your life and some of your research, which is super fascinating, and the final thoughts. So thanks so much for being on the show today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Tony Stovall, who studies the right to consume at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. To continue listening, visit drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding.